Ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to another edition of Did You Bring the Batteries, powered by RMUS. I am once again your podcaster in command. I was about to say commander in command, but that doesn't make sense. Podcaster in command. I only command this podcast, Brian Calhoun. I can put my feet up on the table this week, Kevin Totterell. The lovely and talented Fraser Hahn is out of office. Our friends who joined us last week are not here this week, and it is once again just you and I. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Brian. Kevin Totterell here, and it is exciting to be here. We are. You can't see it, but I want to paint a flowery mantle picture. We're in the new studio, which is really exciting. We have like studio lighting. We have triangular bits of foam on the wall for dulcet tones and sound, and
so you don't hear echoes.
The technical part of it, yes, but to me, it looks cool. So anyway, it's good to be in the new studio, and we've certainly got an exciting guest today, don't we?
We have the head of research at Drone Analyst, David Benowitz. I don't want to spoil the interview. He has had quite a journey and has found himself in a location that you really wouldn't think most people in North America would end up in the drone industry, but he's found his way there. We'll talk about that with him in a second. Before we do, a little housekeeping. We do keep saying that the next week is going to be that Deep Checker show, and if you really are looking forward to that, we will get to that eventually, just a couple of scheduling adjustments we had to make. We talk about this as well in the interview, but it's not just the aerial drone industry. This is the drone industry, so talking about the water-based drones will be a new topic for me, at least. I haven't ever really dived into that world. The depths of it will take a bit of time for us to fully understand, but I promise not to coast my way through it. Backstroke.
You can find yourself submerged in all the detail, right? So it just can happen in those areas. But yeah, Deep Tracker would be interesting to talk about that. We talk about this in terms of multimodal robotics, which is something obviously we are very interested in and we do a lot of. And I think it's a nice market trend that's happening. And yeah, it's exciting. So what else have we got going on here, Brian?
Well, before we sink this entire conversation with more water jokes, I just want to remind everyone that the East Coast Roadshow is continuing on. Actually, it hasn't even started yet, but it will continue on in the sense that we have a coast-to-coast roadshow, and this is going to be the last part, which we have been mentioning week after week. It's because we want to let people know this is happening. The background of radio broadcasting, I learned very early that you actually have to tell somebody something 20 times before they tend to pick it up on a radio station. So a lot of reason for us to repeat these things. So if you remember, greatly appreciate it. But just a reminder, East Coast Roadshow is going to be happening in early August. We'll be stopping off in Fredericton on August 10th and Halifax on August 11th, just to bring a number of the items we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks to show the people of that area.
Actually, Halifax will be Friday the 12th, Brian.
Oh, okay. So Friday the 12th.
I mean, we will be in Halifax on the 11th, but the actual roadshow is on the 12th, which is Friday. So we're excited about that. I don't know. Those of you who are in Halifax are probably telling me not to say anything more, but those of you who are not in Halifax, you should definitely go to Halifax. Beautiful spot. Oceans and everything like that. And so it's nice to have an ocean-to-ocean kind of a roadshow event happening. So this will be this will conclude our roadshow festivities for the summer. It'll be pretty exciting.
And if you are in the area and you want to join us, maybe there is something that we can work out with you, an opportunity that will fit your situation very well. sales@rmus.ca. Once again, sales@rmus.ca is the email address. You can reach out to us and we can see if one of the things that we're bringing will fit your needs. But the podcast, it's an attempt to fit as many needs as possible. So we've talked about specific drones. We've talked about new open source platforms. We've talked about all sorts of things. But until now, we really haven't delved into, I feel like, the nitty gritty of the drone industry, of like how it works. We focused a lot on the actual ships and stuff that you can purchase, the devices you can use. But the industry as a whole is something that we haven't really delved into. So we thought, while we get on our good friend, Dave Benowitz, he is the head researcher at Drone Analyst, and we discussed with him a number of things, but once again, trying to introduce people to the podcast, to the drone industry. So we started off with just a little introduction of asking him, what does he do within the drone industry and how did he end up where he is today?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Currently I'm the head of research at Drone Analyst, which is one of the leading firms behind providing both data and research on the industry and helping brands kind of expand or find their space in the marketplace. And before this, I kind of came and worked before at DJI, where I kind of built up their enterprise marketing division department before kind of joining. So my drone journey has been about 6-7 years now, kind of from that time. And I kind of started off just looking at, as I kind of graduated, what are really cool hardware opportunities in the space. And you kind of saw drones specifically as something that's really badass, and DJI was at the top of it. So I kind of joined them early in like the Phantom 3 days. And everything was, there's no rules, no guidelines, and kind of reached out, was able to join as an intern, and then eventually joined full time and kind of build from there. Kind of before the commercial drone market really existed in many ways, like before Part 107 and all that fun stuff. And it's been a fun ride since.
I feel like you are underselling it just a little bit, because I got into the drone industry through working here. Before that, I started off making my own drones, but I did that within, I don't think I drove more than 10 kilometers away from where I live at any one time to fly my drones. Your journey, slightly further than that in reality.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone's been made aware of this. I'm sure, you know, everyone who follows you on social media and knows who you are knows this, but for those who may not know, you're actually coming to us live from China.
Yeah.
What led you to work specifically in China to accomplish this role?
No, for sure. Yeah. And I'm in Shenzhen, kind of the birthplace of the drone that you own on your table, or whoever's out there listening, you know, that DJI product or Alta or whatever is made not too far away from me. But yeah, I mean, it was just a very exciting opportunity to kind of see. And, you know, at that time I was trying to learn Chinese, and I've since learned Chinese. But it just was a very exciting opportunity to go and see where things are happening, right? Especially in those types of early days for a company that's young, like DJI, and doesn't have much organizational structure. You kind of realize you got to be where the action's at. And when you're young, it's fun to be where the action's at as well. So I kind of just pushed and made it happen. So yeah, it's been fun seeing kind of the drone industry from that perspective, right? Of just very much a global perspective of, you know, the brand that sells the most drones in any country. And having that kind of global perspective and vision as well, and seeing it grow kind of from nothing. So yeah, it's been super fun. My Chinese has improved. My knowledge has improved. And then obviously my pilot skills are still horrible. So yeah.
Well, we got that in common. My pilot skills are certainly pretty awful.
It's
as well.
True. It's yeah. True.
I've been on holiday once, and so some Chinese guy comes up to me. He's like, you know, you're flying pretty poorly. Like, and I'm just like, I don't have the guts to tell him like that I work at the company that made the drone. He's like giving me tips. I've never been embarrassed so much.
Yeah, it's a little different, and I admire the honesty of the people. They'll say, Kevin, you're a bad pilot, and you're also bald, and you're getting fat too. So that's a good time to do so. So be that as it may, I mean, that was a really cool thing. And I remember it pretty fondly, David, when we first met. If you remember the very first ever enterprise product, people don't really know what it was, but of course it was the Z30, right? Yeah. and if you remember, that was yeah, one we were selling for our channel, and all the camera guys, the B&Hs, the Visions here, all those guys, they had to get it from us. And they were saying, why do we have to get it from us? And we were saying, well, this is a camera. Why the hell do they have to get it from us? But it was a start, and you know, it didn't last long. It flipped over and eventually came back to the consumer channel as well. But that was the first foray for DJI in the enterprise space. And obviously they've come a long way, but I think I always feel like, David, that at the heart, they and Autel and all those guys, they're consumer companies, and they don't quite grasp what being an enterprise company means, and what it means to have an enterprise channel versus, you know, Best Buy. What are your thoughts on something like that, and how did you see it evolve while you were there and continue to evolve?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Z30 was the first product I launched, and I've kind of seen it throughout over the time as well. I mean, you know, very much DJI is a consumer company. And you know, even now today, like recently, they just merged their enterprise and consumer marketing, right? Like that's always going to be in their veins. I'd also always just say that like enterprise is different in China than it is in the US. Enterprises tend to consume software and products much more in a consumer fashion in China than in the US as well. And so that's kind of the reason for it. And so, you know, they don't really understand the market as much, and they kind of also see what works. They're moving boxes, not moving solutions per se. They don't have such a deep-rooted history of software sales. SaaS is very new in China as well. So I think it's that big cultural difference behind, you know, what it is. And, you know, I think they've slowly learned. I think Autel and DJI have slowly learned, but they haven't caught up to like what a real enterprise company would do traditionally in the US per se. But that's kind of always been the key difference. I think part of it's a cultural thing. Part of it's just an experience they're going to learn over time. But I just remember getting in meetings like, yeah, early on with you and just like, you know, how do these products work for this? Or what's the language of a utility inspector when you're inspecting a power line? Like at the time, no one knew at DJI. And so we had to kind of figure it out and, you know, exciting times to kind of see on the manufacturer side, how you kind of figure out what works and what the customer expectation is, you know, what type of support you need to offer. whether or not you offer it is a different question, but yeah.
Is that something that you feel like the industry as a whole, not just suffers from, but will be able to get underneath their belt within like the next 5 years? Because you did mention that it's a learning process, and everything is. I can appreciate that more than anyone, just coming in here and learning everything that I've learned over the last little bit of time. But I was just trying to get an understanding of, where are they? How long do you think it's going to take them to get to that point where everything they need to know is under their belt, old hat, and they can move on to the next level and transform into that next thing that the drone industry will have to become to survive?
No, it's a great question. And right. And the answer is that no one really knows. But the real answer is we're going to slowly get there. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the drone industry is still so young, so new. I remember still digging through AeroVironment's financials from last year, and they're like, yeah, the commercial drone industry is still nascent. And by numbers, we are still nascent industry, right? You know, there's not hundreds of thousands of drones in the sky in every city or something like that. And so we're still figuring out our way and still, you know, growing up and maturing. And really, the industry has only been, you know, people have been doing this for a while, but it's really just a 5-6-year-old industry. And so the standards are still being set. They're still being figured out. People are still going through their first phase of hardware in many cases, right? When it comes down to agencies with drone programs, right? Early people are in their second generation or third generation, but many of them are just starting their first generation. And so a lot of this stuff is going to be figured out. You know, I think it's just also at the same time, we have the problem of, you know, DJI does set the cost so low that, you know, it's hard for other alternatives to have alternative approaches to the market, right? If I'm a new manufacturer and I want to offer a much higher level of service or support, well, then I'm not cost competitive. So I definitely think we all need to move on being so price centered and being focused more on the long term as well. What's the total cost of ownership of an airframe if I'm a customer? And then also distributors like RMUS doing a great job of saying, look, you guys need to really think through what the full life cycle is, what service, what training you need, et cetera, and becoming more of a full solution industry instead of just moving hardware.
I think it's a great assessment. And I think we probably had this conversation over beers in Las Vegas at one point, but I know I certainly had it, but I was always shocked, you know, whatever it was 3-4 years ago, I thought, okay, well, the no brainer for this, you know, at the time the XT1 had just come out, you know, Thermal was the, you know, that was the first kind of killer app that was starting to drive adoption. And it was like, okay, well,
yeah,
FLIR ultimately owns the technology, right? So it was a very weird relationship in that, you know, DJI needed FLIR as much as FLIR needed DJI. And that was not, you know, that was not a normal position. And it is still not a normal position in the market. And I always thought, well, why the hell wouldn't FLIR just, you know, just make their own M210 version and come out with a, you know, with a non-DJI, whether it was US made, it wasn't as big of a deal at that point, but it was just like something that wasn't DJI, where allegedly we as FLIR, you know, we know how to do channel, we know how to do enterprise. DJI doesn't, but they never did, right? And I'm wondering, is that, you know, was that just because they were afraid, or technically they couldn't do it, or I mean, drones is hard. I mean, why didn't somebody step up and just try and do that before the latest iteration of the Blue SUAS here?
I mean, you have to think as well from FLIR's perspective, like their bread and butter is not commercial; their bread and butter is military, and they have had a few successful plays in that space with the Hornet. I think just a few months ago they made like $110 million. In hardware sales. And there's not many drone companies doing $110 million in hardware sales per year. I'll tell you that in the drone industry. You know, we might see a few billion-dollar valuations, but none of them are that close to that in actual real revenue. So, you know, they are successful in hardware just in the military space. But I would just say it's not really in their DNA to do that and also to compete on price at that scale. You know, they've done so well with like cornering the thermal market and really offering improvements on that in the technology, the manufacturing, et cetera. But, you know, they're moving those at scale. I don't think they can really compete with a company like DJI who has that consumer roots at scale, at cost, when they need to develop flight control technology, they need to develop their own motors, they need to work on the airframe design, et cetera. You know, so there's a lot more that goes into it, right? it kind of goes back to like, why does XYZ company fail when they enter the drone space, or why is it so hard to have a US made drone? And it just becomes, there's a lot that goes into it. And a lot of these new companies, they rely on open source technology. It's just not as good as the DJI made stuff, just because it's not custom made for that airframe, right? And so there's so many steps that comes down to competing with a DJI style player, right? Where they've built the flight control themselves. That's where they started from, flight control technology. They've built, you know, the ESE logic to their own level. They've built all the software to themselves on their own level. They've built obstacle detection themselves on their own level. They're getting down to the chip logic that's influenced by them as well. So, you know, how can you really compete at every level of the tech stack when you're not, don't have that history of doing it necessarily? It's much harder than you think. So I would never blame a FLIR for not entering the market, right? They have a very good business model. They have many different paths they can enter. And the investment to really seriously compete in the drone space is huge.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the unfortunate tale of the GoPro Karma, which is a wonderful parallel to this entire conversation. I mean, it seems like easy, common sense things that you and I and Kevin here are talking about, where when you get down to programming ESCs to torque the motors in a specific way, that's an entire skill set in and of itself, which no one at GoPro probably had that time. So there are plenty of external factors already that are causing these sorts of issues for new companies getting into the industry. But there's also some man-made ones as well, like the Blue SUAS program. And that is an effort, depending on who you talk to, of trying to level the playing field, if you will. It cuts out the government's purchasing of drones from two of the biggest players in the industry and probably another half a dozen smaller entities that just don't make that list because of the region of the world that they are from. And I was just wondering, what do they think about that program in China and how in North America there are these laws that are trying to quote unquote level the playing field?
Yeah, I mean, in general, there's a lot of conversation in the US about it being nationalistic or unfair in the business practices. What I would always point out the fact is that I don't have Facebook in China. You know, I have to legally access it. So, you know, the US is not the first people to invent blocking, you know, companies from entering a market. So I always think, it, you know, that's the general argument in China, though, is that it's unfair. They're cheating because they can't win. That's always kind of been the sentiment. But I would always just point out that, like, that's the most, from a Chinese perspective, is a hard argument to really make on like a geopolitical scale. What I like to say, like, before we dive into the details of Blue SUS, is just like step out and think about the geopolitics of it. And I know it's always not the most fun topic to think about, but I think the FLIR kind of topic plus the Blue SUS topic is really great, which is, you know, if you look at what's happened with thermal cameras in the drone space, DJI has been essentially moving away from FLIR. It has been creating their own supply chain from which they can require and manufacture more and more thermal cameras. And FLIR is really locked on that globally, right? That's been the history of the world. It's really been FLIR being so proactive on that space, dominating it globally, and it being a dual use technology, both on the military and commercial side of things. And there are export controls to it. I think we'll see kind of a similar thing with drones, and the Blue SUS is kind of the first step to it, which is we see in Ukraine, a regular drone that's even used for consumer use could be used to harm people. And it's a very similar technology in that way that it is inherently dual use. And over time, these geopolitical powers are going to really battle over who controls the production of these types of products. Because if a war happens, owning the production to dual use technology is going to be very valuable in wartime. And so I just like always think we need to always reflect back to that. That's what's really happening, both with DJI maybe diversifying their thermal suppliers and the Blue SUS thing. Whether or not it works as a productive and executed well is another question, right? I mean, we've all seen as well a lot of these Blue SUS manufacturers maybe not being able to deliver real products that could be able to produce, or reliable products, or maybe at the similar competitive price, yet people are kind of in some way pushed to purchasing them as well. So there's a little bit on both sides that happens. Yeah. Government execution is never top notch.
So from that perspective, I mean, obviously we had geopolitical and different reasons why we had a Blue SUAS. So now you've got your, I think it's coming out maybe next week, your drone analyst report. And you cover a lot of these things and topics, but let's kind of segue into not necessarily the Blue SUAS specifically, though it's part of it, but let's look at some of the marketplace as a whole first, and then we can dive down. So what what have you seen in terms of marketplace trends for market share? You know, who are some of the up and comers? Who is losing ground? And who are some of the people that you're really watching, either technology wise or company specific?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And you know, we've kind of seen both the Blue SUS stuff and a lot new entrants into the market, and then also just more diverse airframes, right? You know, a few years back, a fixed wing like the Wingtra or the Sensefly just wasn't really purchased that often, and it's becoming a bit more common to purchase that type of airframe as well. And so we've seen kind of DJI's market share diminish over time. And so each year we do conduct a survey to figure out market share, brand market share. We'll be launching the same survey next week where we'll be collecting that similar data. So if you're listening, look out for that and hopefully you know, participate in helping to gather that data, which will be published. But yeah, we've really seen over the past 2 years kind of DJI diminish from a super, super dominant space where they were upwards of 70% to being upwards of 50% market share in the global commercial drone market. So that's kind of been the key trend that we've kind of seen. And then big winners are, you know, surprisingly, Autel. You know, they're still a Chinese manufacturer, but they're not in the media storm every day. And so a lot of people said, look, these products are pretty similar to DJI, so let's try them out. I won't get as much flack for them. But then obviously Skydio has been gaining a little bit, hit with production constraints, but still gaining quite a bit. We've seen other companies like Freefly be gaining. I think Brink is another great example as well, been gaining. But I think overall, what it gets me excited about the industry, especially on like the hardware trends that I've really seen, is that although we have had some, I would say, kind of destruction in the same space, which is the Blue SUS companies are all competing on the same SKU, and maybe not all of them can deliver. But we're also seeing some really, really focused products. I think the Brink drones is a perfect example of that, right? You know, DJI doesn't have a product that can shatter glass, that has that kind of drop microphone thing, and a few of these other features that the Lemur does. And I think that type of hardware is what we'll see when we get we get more manufacturers that are US or Europe based, that are much closer to customers than DJI, who's, you know, trying to focus on a few models that they can move a lot of boxes of. And so that's what really gets me kind of excited, is like how much customization we're going to get. Even Autel with the Dragonfish, right? Like there's nothing competing from DJI from that. And once we get more brands that have market share, have revenue they can commit to R&D, we're going to keep on seeing this type of diversity and capabilities happening.
Yeah, I think it's I think that's something we're seeing too. And it's, and I think from a manufacturer perspective, again, Brink is a great example, but there are other ones where, you know, before the niches, like you couldn't play in a niche and make enough money to survive, right? Particularly if you had VC investors that were, you know, demanding quarterly results, right? And so,
yeah,
so that was a big deal. And now, you know, you're starting to get these things that are you know, specialized enough where there's money in there, so people will pay a premium. They're not price sensitive. I'm thinking kind of specifically about the flyability model, right? Like that's a great example, right? Everybody thinks they can make it. Nobody has. It's really expensive, you know, super high margins, but nobody can duplicate it. And the, you know, they, every time, you know, they have about, whatever, 100 plus people in Switzerland, that can't be cheap. So clearly there's money in the niches. And then I think it's kind of compounded by the fact that, you know, DJI is making these the best sort of solid platforms, but the problem is now there's just too many things. So all these third party PSDK sensors, you know, the integrations are terrible. The support is terrible. So it goes back to the strengths you said of DJI was they're doing everything in-house, their ESC logic, their chip logic, and that's making them awesome. But the sensors are not, right? And so the overall experience is going to be less than if somebody has maybe not as good a platform, but they actually have an integration and it works, right? So, you know, maybe it cost me more. It's doing one thing only, but it does that one thing, and I don't have to worry about being in the field and trying to find somebody that can tell me why, you know, I can't get my screen on, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. And I even think it was the funniest is like looking at, you know, DJI's like product line from 2018, 2019 to now, right? They had the M100, the M600, the M200, the Inspire 2, the Phantom 4 Pro, the Phantom 4 RTK, the Phantom 4 Multispectral, the Mavic 2 Enterprise Zoom, the Mavic 2 Enterprise Dual. You know, that's 900 plus SKUs that they had at once on the market. Now they've really cut that down to just Mavic 2 Enterprise Advanced, M30, M300, Phantom 4 RTK. So now we're down to something like 4 SKUs. And I really think it just shows that, like, you know, they need to preserve their margin if they're going to compete on price. And you can't do that with so many SKUs. And so that's a key thing. And that's also where a lot of, you know, investment from these other players really is going to be. But, you know, I think the open ecosystem is what I'm really excited about in the future, too. I mean, we've seen like the Altarion type of ecosystem, you know, which I think is kind of the future, is super exciting, right? The idea that we could have an open source, and we do have an open source flight controller, but an open source payload SDK, where a free fly that, you know, might be flying a cinema camera one day, and somebody releases a payload SDK that's designed for another platform, but it meets the same standard, can then be mounted on my free fly. So I think that is where the industry eventually needs to move, and we're even seeing that. So, you know, we might say the original BlueSUS 1.0 is kind of faulty, but if you look at like their later ones, they are starting to call for some of these open standards like Mavlink protocol and et cetera that are pushing for more open source standards, because these large enterprises benefit the most. Imagine being a utility company deploying 200 drones and you have a thermal camera. They're both a FLIR Tau 2, but it doesn't work on that drone. It only works on that drone. It doesn't make sense. The same thing if you have a remote controller. Why does it work with that drone but not the other drone? And it's really the future is this type of open standard where, you know, my drone works with that remote controller and those payloads as well, even if it's not bought from the same brand or in the same year per se.
And I know what drives me nuts as somebody who advocates for the customer and is dealing with the customer every day is how frustrating that process can be. And I think of, you know, I think of the Watts Prism platform. It works awesome. And we tried forever to get a WIRIS sensor working on there. They just wouldn't talk to each other. It just couldn't be done. And then it's like, we're going to switch Prism Sky. We're going to be on the Altarion, and WIRIS is on the Altarion. And then it's still, you know, it's still not really working right. The theory is there though, you know, same thing with FreeFly, where it's like, okay, we're trying to integrate a sensor on there, you know, so now everybody's on Altarion. They can do it, but they don't play well with the Grimsy gimbal. Right. So they're going to make, you know, they're going to say, well, we're making our own gimbal. And it's like, well, don't make your own gimbal. The Grimsy gimbal is awesome. Just figure out, get Grimsy involved in the party, and you know, you're not a DJI. You don't have millions of dollars of development money. So partner with people and do this, right? And so I was just gonna say,
I've always heard of those kinks, and it's like it's the best concept, but it's hard to execute in reality. But I just remember those early days, like talking to brands like, yeah, you gotta go one by one. You know, we make this many units. Do you think it's worth your time to become compatible with us? And it's like, nah, not really. You know, especially a few years back, it's like, it only is worth people's time to be compatible with DJI. And that just, it hurts the whole industry, right? When it's not just, you don't need to just compete on price, you need to compete on capabilities, but you also need to compete on compatibility. And it's like, you got to either build it yourself or get big enough to the point where people build it for you. And, you know, this lowers the barrier to cost, but you're right, it's hard to implement. But I think the Watts is a perfect example, right? It's a badass platform. Can I say badass? I
don't. Yes, you can. Yes.
It's a very badass platform. It's rugged as hell. It's big. It's reliable. But yeah, until it has that very open ecosystem around it, it's a bit harder of an investment to make.
Yeah, and I think it's hard for the sensor manufacturers to find that as well. And that's why, you know, going back to the BlueSUS a little bit, that to me is kind of fascinating. Like when you look at Skydio and Teal specifically, let's leave kind of Parrot and Vantage out of it. But, you know, Skydio is trying to do that Apple model, right? They're in the Valley. That's what they do, right? So let's make it all integrated and not really play, you know, and then Teal's got that partnership with Autonodyne, and they're saying, no, we can't build everything. We're going to try and do this. They're, you know, they're partnering with FLIR on some of the new sensors. And you know, personally, I think that's going to be the victor in this, because you know, no matter how much money you raise, it's like, it's nice to have a $1 billion valuation, but you still got to do this, and you know, you got to have it fast. Right. And so I like the idea of these guys that are really, really specialized. So I don't know, what are some of your thoughts on that?
No, I think you make the perfect point, right? Which is, but I think we're missing the VC standpoint, which is, why would I value at over $1 billion with a few million in sales if you're not building everything yourself, or your technology is not better than everyone else's? And so that's kind of where the conversation starts. And so the question is, you know, what's the benefit for the customer and future market share for the brand, versus what's the best for raising the next round? And so sometimes we're put in that position, right, where, you know, maybe VCs don't realize that, but if we could be the next DJI, quote unquote, instead of being the number one partner on that Terran ecosystem, well, one's going to get a higher valuation, even if they can't necessarily achieve it, right? I think that there's some perverse incentives there. I love the concept of what Skydio is doing, but you're right, I think for customers today, it's it's a hard journey unless you're working exactly where their software is great at. Like I can imagine for utilities, their Skydio 3D scan platform is great for vertical asset inspections. But outside of that, it's like, I wish there was something more flexible.
I think you make a great point in terms of the proprietary nature of what they're looking for in valuations. And so I wonder if it's, you know, let's face it, every VC wants you to be a SaaS company, right? They want software recurring revenue. That's what they want because
they want why they make margins, the most, at least.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's where the most money is to be made, yeah. Right? And so even though customers hate it, everybody hates it, but the VCs are like, if you want money and you want a valuation, that's what you got to do. I think it's really, really hurting the North American hardware industry in general, right? Because I think it's just taking away investment money. The VCs and such, they don't want to invest in hardware, right? Because they've kind of given up. And that's what I worry the most about from that perspective.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing with a few of these smaller, more niche plays is that there's a new pool of VCs that are kind of outside of that Bay Area VC kind of generic go big or go home, all or nothing kind of approach that are investing in it, right? Like, you know, we're seeing investors for Quantum Systems. We're seeing investors for Brink. We're seeing investors for a lot of these drone companies that are not at the same valuation as Skydio is. But maybe that's because they have, you know, a much more near term, but also more applicable model as well. And it's not going to boom up. They're not going to overtake DJI in one fell swoop. But you are seeing that as well. But you definitely see a different VC group investing in these type of plays than Skydio per se, which I find quite interesting. But you're right. I mean, it's just like what gets those guys talking, right? You know, when you raise I just saw like the Sequoia Cap China fund is like over, I should look up the number, but it's a several billion dollars. And it's like, well, if you're investing several billion dollars in a company that makes a million or two in revenue, that, you know, you're not going to get a lot of money if you're looking at a bunch of $100 million plays. And that's kind of where it goes for a lot of these Bay Area type plays, unfortunately. Yeah.
I feel like you guys have definitely expanded on what the future of the industry is. But you know, these customers that we're dealing with, these people that we're trying to help them build out their programs, what are some of the current trends in the industry right now that you think people should be made aware of?
I mean, I think we've seen a few that we've kind of been talking about, and we'll summarize them, right? Like the move slowly towards open source and more compatibility. It's the building blocks are there. They have kinks to work out, but that's something that's going to be huge for customers in the future. I think that's quite big. I think also the trend we've just seen is that like thermals become so standard now that like that's just people buy dual camera payloads. They're just thermal plus visual, probably with zoom on it. That's kind of the big standard that's kind of happened in the short term. And then there's just something we were kind of talking about before, but eventually I think, you know, not just being the drone industry, but being kind of a robotics industry, which is just everything kind of unmanned. And, you know, realizing that a public safety department, they're not just going to need things flying, they're going to need things on the ground as well. I don't know, Kevin, you've obviously had a lot of experience with that at RMUS with you guys selling the spot and everything. And how have you kind of seen that? Do you see a lot of overlap as well where people are kind of branching out to just being air-based to being more mixed?
Yes, absolutely on that one. And it's funny because a lot of the things you've got common challenges, if you think about the way these things is like anything remotely operated, it kind of has the same macro issues that you're dealing with, right? I got to figure about how do I communicate with it, right? Like, so what happens if there's interference? How do I maintain it, right? And most of these systems, they have some similarities in terms of how they're maintained. And then the other big thing is how do I get the data out of it and into something useful, whether that's going to be some kind of streaming of live inspection or live incidents, or whether that's going to be just, you know, having people share inspection reports or maps or whatever. And so that's what we found is, you know, we were dealing with the same issue, like in a public safety. Is it ATAC compatible? Can we get our data into, you know, some kind of a command center stream situation? Well, you know, the guys that had the bomb robots, they were trying to do exactly the same thing as the guys that were flying, right? And so all of that really drove to say, well, how do we do that? And some of the other stuff will then be, you know, how can we have single control for all our, whether it's underwater ROVs, whether it's UGVs, can we control that on one thing? So it's all kind of converging. And just like on the inspection side for the data collection, right? It's like, okay, well, now we got the serial data, but we certainly have scenarios where, you know, maybe we can't get close enough or we can't get the right angle from the air. Can we combine that with some ground data? What about indoor and outdoor? I mean, one of the big things for us is like with the Emerson hover map, right? We can do a single scan of the interior of a structure, hand scan, quickly throw it on the drone on the same scan, and then you're getting a full exterior scan too. So you have that 3D model internally and out. So definitely very important.
Yeah, I mean, it even makes sense for a lot of these drone programs to kind of become slowly like data acquisition programs or just robotics programs, right? Because it's the same thing, right? Whether or not it's on something that looks like a dog or something that looks like a bird, it's all for the same purpose.
I will admit, though, that I was caught off a little off guard by you saying that thermal is a current trend. It's clearly a massive thing in here, but it's so massive that you almost think it's, at least to me, I almost think of it like it's a past trend because everyone's already doing it. So if thermal is kind of a current trend, then what would you consider people that are just coming into the industry should definitely stay away from? As we mentioned before, this industry is so nascent and changes all the time. As you evolve, there are things that just get left behind. So if someone's coming into the industry, very little experience, what are some of the things that you would suggest? These are in the past. Everyone might have documented them thoroughly, but stay away from that because you want to move on to open source or whatever.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, Kevin, have you had these conversations recently with customers too?
Well, yes, but we want to put you on the spot on this one, David.
Yeah, it's a really good question. That's always too good. I mean, I think it's always true to just like not buy into the marketing hype, right? Like, and really test it out for real. You know, like we're talking about open source, we're talking about all this stuff, but you know, it's the hope. It's not necessarily that it works out well, right? Like Kevin's already kind of shown that, like, you know, it doesn't always work out in reality. So I think that's always kind of the key thing. And then also people always marketing towards BVLOS, 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 BVLOS. Yes, BVLOS rules are kind of coming into place, but don't bet your money on BVLOS. Do what's able to be done today. And the same thing with autonomy, right? We're seeing more and more people release drone-in-a-box systems. I've even seen people talk to me before in past roles and whatnot saying, look, we're going to adopt drones when it becomes fully autonomous. And I think it always comes back to just deploying step by step is always the best way to do it and building from the ground up and avoiding these kind of buzzwords or keywords that kind of happen out there. But you don't need a dock to be successful. You know, you don't need to be able to do remote to be successful. That'll help you scale later. But unless you know what the operations are, the benefits are of your drone program, you're not going to end up investing 200K in a drone dock plus drone when you can't justify the 10K that's manually operated, you know? And so I think that's the key thing, right? It's avoiding these buzzwords or avoiding to go immediately to the full solution or the perfect solution that's been marketed by a company that hasn't deployed enough units quite yet.
It's funny you should mention drone in the box because I was going to ask you about that specifically because everybody in their dog, I guess we should start saying everybody in their spot, no pun intended, has come up with one of these.
Exactly.
It was actually pretty funny. Like, I don't mean to be mean to some of my competitors, but I'm going to be. So one of our competitors here locally who is the you know, we're trying to do everything for everyone everywhere. And they just announced they were launching a drone in a box of their own, which, you know, hurrah for them. I'm excited, right? I'm a short seller of their stock.
I already know who you're talking about. They're Canadian based, right?
Yes, they are. So,
we're not going any further.
Yeah, no. So anyway, I'm a short. Yeah. I'm short the stock, so I hope they do it. But it was so funny because that came out, and then like 2 days later was the acquisition that American Robotics bought, and I can't remember the name of it. The
Aerobotics.
And I've actually talked to those guys. It's kind of a cool product, actually. Kudos to them. But what was it, $18 million after a $100 million investment? And so I was tempted to say, hey, competitor, go ahead and launch that drone in a box.
Yeah.
But then you look at something like Percepto, which is obviously we're biased, but that's a really advanced platform. And the biggest strength we're finding as we start to implement them is the software. People love the software. Right? The out-of-the-box AI that's actually deployable, it works. And they're saying, yeah, who gives a shit about the drone in the box? That's nice. How do we get all of our data onto this software? And so that was the biggest shock for us. So So maybe when we talk about some of the trends, David, let's talk about software and the state of software in the drone industry. What are your thoughts there? What do you see as some of the things you're watching and where the growth will be there?
Yeah. No, I mean, software is always kind of the key component, right? And we've seen quite a few new entrants, a few exits as well from Skyward, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, I've always seen kind of the, on the data analytics side, more of a consolidation around drone deploy PIX4D for everything mapping. But we've still seen some shakeups in public safety and some other kind of more niche software with like SkyBrowse, et cetera. So that's always gotten me excited to see kind of what's the new insights analytics that's kind of out there. And then you've also always seen kind of the software integrated with service. And that's quite exciting as well. So you probably just saw like Inspection 2 was acquired by DroneBase. And I do see eventually that, you know, not everyone's going to be outsourcing services. A lot of drone programs won't outsource it. For those that do, having that integrated service that's always tied into the acquisition and the processing, because once you can get that at scale, you can do some really cool machine learning and eventually AI components to it as well. And that's one of the big things. We always see people throw in AI. It doesn't work that well with drones for a few reasons. The number one reason being that, in general, the data does not always look that similar for a lot of these applications, unless you're specifically around a construction site and just detecting objects. But for really impactful AI to detect change or detect specific faults, you know, on transmission lines and whatnot, like the SKUs for components on a transmission line is so many when you're out there in the world. It's much harder to do AI on what's out there in the remote world than what's in an office, for example. And so I think that's like a really powerful combination that'll be happening there as well. But yeah, so back to the trends I've always seen is like market share consolidation between those two players. A few more niche plays that you're kind of seeing there grow as well, which is always quite exciting. That's kind of the key thing. You've also, of course, seen like a lot of drone operations management software come and go, like the rise of AirData and a few other players. Aloft, of course, doing really well. But then at the same time, the fall of Skyward. And the fact is that they haven't really figured out how to monetize their platform that well, despite it being really helpful for users. They just don't really see that it's necessarily worth a few thousand a month, per se.
What I did want to ask is, we'll go back to that investing theme. You have a unique perspective of, you know, sort of foot in the valley, foot in China. But now you have been promoted. Congratulations! I wanted to share that with you. You are now the head of the Sequoia Drone Fund. You've been given $3 billion. Congratulations for that. And so it's the David Benowitz Sequoia Memorial Fund. So talk to me about your first round of investments. Like, so now the future, what are you betting other people and your own money on for the future of the drone industry?
Yeah. I mean, I think you see a few different plays that are more open source, I think is number one, both on the hardware and kind of the development side. It's like, you know, Are we naming specific companies, or are we just?
Well, you can name companies or industries, whatever you want. Yeah.
I mean, I think obviously there's being able to have that software plus services mix is super big. So you look at like companies like DroneBase that are doing very well, or Drone Deploy that just has that big trove of data, and being able to do that at a much larger scale, and then also Drone Deploy being a play that's also in the robotic space with their acquisition of Rokos being really attractive. Those two companies, even they might be valued a little high on the hardware. You know, I think you kind of go that both those two ways, right? That we've talked about, which is one is trying for those brands that are a bit more open, like a Free Fly, like a Watts, that can really scale, but also kind of be more open, but recognizing that that's kind of a bit more of a long-term play. So also going for some more nuanced niche businesses that are trying to do one thing really, really, really well, like a Brink Drones is an example of that. Is kind of where I would kind of split it. So you have these kind of bigger software plays, these more targeted hardware plays, and the hardware plays are much longer focused. The software plays a bit more near term. That's my fund.
So outside of China and, you know, North America, what other, is there another country that you're really bullish on the drone industry there? Or?
Yeah, well, I think India is going to see some big growth pretty soon. And for a few reasons. So the number one is that the Modi government there, the prime minister there, has been super, super supportive of the drone industry very recently, and is investing big time in really getting up operations and use to a high scale. And at the same time, they do have a lot of rules limiting on the origin of the product. So it won't be a flood of Chinese products. So they're going to have a lot of domestic growth in that country. Is going to be perfect. A perfect example of that is in ag. They're essentially following kind of the China model where, you know, because they do have a lot of poor farmers and who live in pretty bad conditions. So they're essentially subsidizing their use of agriculture spraying drones, which is going to have a huge benefit to like their quality of life, but also just get the industry moving. So that's somewhere that you would certainly invest. And there's a few companies there that are doing okay with it. And then there's another company that'll be at CUAV Expo in just over a month, which is IdeaForge, who's been really doing well there in the military space and might be doing some exciting things in the drone industry here in the US, as it seems like that's the first real activity they've done. So that's one thing I'm also looking at is India will have some big growth. Japan we've seen on the software side, but nothing too super exciting. But those are like kind of the main markets. And then, you know, we already see a lot of European businesses in the US already. Altarion gets me a little excited there just for the open source play. But, you know, I think we've always called out it's going to take a while for that to really get to scale because you need all boats to rise first, like more payload developers, more everything as well. And I think one thing the industry is kind of missing is like that really, you know, the FLIR, but in other spaces, right? FLIR does thermal super well. Their sensors and cores are amazing. But we don't really see like generic across the brand camera companies. Like if Gramsci did not just gimbals, but did the whole integrated system with great zoom or whatnot, and just integrated a FLIR in addition to that, that's more broadly compatible. That would be a very interesting company I'd love to see in the drone space. It's hard to justify that business model when the hardware is at the state it's at, or the platforms at the state it's at, but that's also something that would be quite exciting in the next few years.
That was Dave Benowitz. He is the head researcher at Drone Analyst, or at least maybe he was in the past. I don't think we have rules for this, but I'd like to petition for the drone industry to have Highlander rules. So since I stumped him on one of those questions where I asked him about where the drone industry was departing from, perhaps that makes me the drone analyst? Question mark? Highlander rules? No? No? Okay, we'll leave him with it. I'll stick to solving problems and breaking hearts. Once again, though, my title here is Podcast in Command, and I fulfilled those duties for another week along with...
Kevin Zotterill.
And this week, we actually do have those batteries you mentioned last time. It's not that every battery in the world is here, but we did mention a little bit of a backup in the supply chain, and at least for those, we have... somewhat ease those restrictions. Those batteries, they're actually on the shipping dock, so I gotta go unpack them right now.